Councilmember Cameron, Sean Patrick, Borough Cavalry Council.
Hold on, just one moment. All right, you may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Stephen Charnoff. I represent the appellants, Spectre 4 LLP and Spectet Limited Partnership LLP. Chief Justice Clemens, I do wish to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Three.
Thank you. Your Honors, this case presents what is admittedly a complex factual background, but I believe that it gives rise to matters of significant import to contract law in Virginia, to implied-in-fact contracts, and this case may be perhaps the clearest implied-in-fact contract fact pattern this Court has ever dealt with, as well as the issue of waiver, which is, of course, always of interest in contract law, and waiver-only-in-writing clauses, which the Court does not have a lot of case law on and is, of course, of great interest to practitioners throughout the Commonwealth. Your Honors, I'm going to briefly address the factual background of this case, and then I'll move on to the contracts implied in fact, which were found to exist in this case, and then I'm going to address the alleged waiver of a clause in a terminated written agreement, and then the waiver-only-in-writing clause that existed in the terminated written agreements. Your Honors, in 1995 and 1996, my clients, Spectre 4 and Spectet, entered into written agreements with a company called Jefferson LBG LLC. And Jefferson LBG, in 1995, 1996, 1997, managed these two office buildings in Reston, Virginia. On December 31st, 1997, Jefferson LBG's corporate existence was terminated by the Virginia State Corporation Commission. The trial court held correctly that at the moment of the entity's termination, the written agreements terminated as well. And the way the trial court analogized it was as if it was the death of a party to a contract.
On January 1st, the original agreements had a 2-year initial term, is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And there was no automatic renewal in the agreement?
There was no automatic
renewals in the agreement. It required some act by one of the parties to continue to renew the agreement.
Your Honor, I would have to spend time looking at that particular clause. My recollection is that there is a renewal term and that the contracts were to renew every 2 years. I don't recall whether it required a particular action on the part of the parties, but what happened was, factually, the first contracts entered into in 95 by one of the parties.
What I'm trying to get at is, certainly the contract expired in 97 when the party was canceled, the corporate party was canceled. But the 6-month liquidated damage provision appears to be tied to a 2-year initial term set of agreements, which implies to a commercial lawyer negotiating these things that the parties wanted expectations of a certain term, 2 years. And therefore, if one of them wanted to walk without proper cause, you got to pay the liquidated damage fee. But that was well overtaken by events, as you pointed out, on like 5 different series of changes of entity status. And I don't understand why the 6-month term and the liquidated damages provision within it would be relevant to a termable at will implied in contract anyway.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. I mean, our position in this case is that there's no written agreement between the parties, none whatsoever.
Well, the trial court agreed with you with that.
And the trial court did agree, and then the trial court took an additional step and said, even though these are implied contracts, meaning that they are conduct contracts, the court is going to incorporate the entire 25 or 29 page, 79 article/subarticle express agreements into the conduct contracts, even though at trial there was no evidence of the parties comporting with something like 60, I think it was 59 of the articles or subarticles in the contract. It's literally unprecedented in the Commonwealth.
Let's walk back for just 1 second. Spectre 4 has a contract with Jefferson LGV. Jefferson LGV ceases existence and expires according to the State Corporation Commission. Jefferson Commercial takes over and simply performs what would have been the Jefferson LGV contract because the parties are the same. Are we all right now?
Your Honor, I would not agree with that.
Parties in the sense of Ms. Farrar.
Ms. Farr?
Farr, yeah.
I would respectfully disagree with one thing, which is that Spectat and Spectra 4 alleged contracts implied in fact, so all we were looking to demonstrate was what...
We're getting there.
Okay.
Ms. Farr was the head of Jefferson LGB, and she's the head of Jefferson Commercial, correct?
She was the owner of both. There was no evidence of them being alter egos or not...
We're getting there, too. Hold on.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Hold on. Jefferson Commercial, at some point in time, there's an asset purchase by Univest. There's no written contract that was able to be purchased in the asset purchase because there wasn't any contract to assign or purchase, correct?
Correct. Yes.
All right. So my question to you, and if you haven't gathered this, this is a friendly question, is at what point is there an implied in fact contract? It would seem to me that the contract becomes no longer express, but becomes implied in fact very early in this chain of events. All the way back when Jefferson Commercial started taking over the duties that had been expressly contained in the contract with Jefferson LGB. Is it your position that that's when the implied in fact contract began?
Yes, absolutely. January 1st, 1998, it's Jefferson Commercial that's managing these buildings. But there's no express agreement. There's no oral contract. There's no written contract.
We have three kinds of contracts. Express, it'd be oral or written. Implied in fact or implied in law.
Yes, sir.
And there's no question this isn't express at this point. Then there's no question this isn't implied in law. This is an implied in fact contract.
Absolutely, Your Honor. At January 1st, 1998 through 98-99, it's a contract implied in fact. And Univest's contract implied in fact begins somewhere in 2000.
So in order to determine what is the content of this implied in fact contract, you have to look at the conduct of the parties, not the prior express agreement between two other parties.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And I believe we successfully proved our contracts implied in fact, meaning that the court agreed these were contracts implied in fact. And what happened was the building management company went in and collected the rent from all the commercial tenants, deposited them into operating accounts, paid itself each month for 12 years. If I may touch on that point, I do feel this is a straightforward contract case. Well, it's not straightforward or else I wouldn't be here. But the equities, I do believe, are with my client, by which I mean, by Univest's position, they would have required my clients, if in fact these express agreements were binding on my client, which they were not, but if they were, they would have required my clients, Spectet and Spectre 4, to terminate these contracts in 2002 in order to properly invoke the just cause basis without waiver. And thus they would have deprived themselves of 10 years of profitable business between 2002 and 2012, and they wouldn't have gotten the liquidated damages back in 2002 because that's right at the time that Ms. Farr was terminated as the president of the building management company. So I don't know why that would be the result, and it doesn't seem to be...
Well, you don't have to rely on equities for anybody, do you? I mean, this is a matter of law.
Your Honor, I do believe that
Don't you stray into unfortunate territory inviting a response that you don't have to actually deal with when you do that?
Perhaps, Your Honor, and I'll move right away from that. And what I'll talk about is...
Let me ask you a different question, Counsel. Isn't there some case law out there that says that you can have an implied in fact contract that subsumes or takes over the terms of an express contract? In other words, there are cases where people had an express contract and that contract ended and they kept on acting as if they were still under the same contract.
Yes, Your Honor. Those
that's the second question, though. But what would you have to prove, then, in this case, to show that what conduct would you have to establish to show that the implied in fact contract did in fact incorporate the terms of the express agreement in this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that raises a great question, which is why those cases that were cited in the appellee's brief were from other jurisdictions, which found that in certain instances, they were really labor and employment agreements that had termed out the expiration dates of the contract had occurred, and the parties kept working and being paid for work, and the courts held that the contracts, that they had implied in fact contracts to abide by the express agreements. But I think what you end up having to do, and there's many reasons you don't want to import that sort of law into Virginia, is one, you're going to eviscerate contract expiration terms. That's never going to be the case again. I mean, the expiration terms are going to be disregarded by this court, despite the fact that this court respects the right of parties to choose whatever terms they wish to put into their contracts, so long as they don't violate public policy or statute. But it also is going to introduce something into the trial courts, which is this. At what point have they abided by enough of the express agreement to import the rest of it? Is it 40%? Is it 45%? Is it 80%? Why? I don't know why the court would make new law to introduce that uncertainty.
But once again, similar to the Chief's earlier question to you, why is it necessary to go that far with your argument? Those cases where an implied in fact contract have the effect of incorporating by reference a previous express contract were always between the same parties, never between dissimilar parties.
Which I absolutely agree, and that is what I argue.
So if UniWest had been, in fact, at one point part of the express contract, that might be on the table, and that would be a question for the court to answer, but it doesn't appear to me it is.
I agree, Your Honor. I was responding to Justice Millett's hypothetical, but I 100% agree. In every one of those cases that were cited by UniWest, it was the two parties to the express written agreement that then expired, and they kept conducting themselves. That's not true here. We have an additional layer. We have another party that was in the middle between UniWest. UniWest and my clients never signed any. Throughout this entire, we're now 20 years into the chronology of this event, I've never signed a contract, never had an oral contract of any sort. So that's just not applicable to these circumstances. And
counsel, is there any significance to the fact that your client asked UniWest to subordinate itself on the lender agreement? Does that indicate an intent on their part, or what? How does that play into this?
Your Honor, I reread that subordination agreement this morning. There are a couple things. One, my client didn't sign that. That's if you look at the subordination agreement. It's not signed by my client. Two, that subordination agreement references Jefferson LBG LLC, and the signature line even says Jefferson LBG LLC, and UniWest did sign it, but they signed AKA UniWest Commercial. But that wasn't true. They were never Jefferson LBG. They never used it as a trade name. That was never what they were. It was a distinct entity. And I do tend to think that in light of how strong the case law is in this Commonwealth regarding what it takes for an implied waiver, it has to be clear and convincing evidence. The only thing that UniWest pulled out at trial for demonstrating waiver in 12 years was a single subordination agreement that references any management agreement, which would, of course, encompass one that had been entered into between the parties, but none had been entered into the parties here. Your Honors, I am into my rebuttal time. Unless there are any further questions, I'll sit down.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Sean Roach on behalf of UniWest Commercial Realty. The core issue before the Court really is a waiver issue. And specifically, were there facts to support Judge Devine's findings of fact?
But you don't get to waiver if the judge erred in finding that a liquidation damage provision of a two-year initial term contract, as a matter of law, is part of a implied in fact contract between two different parties.
That's correct.
If that doesn't
correct.
Exist, there's nothing to weigh.
That's correct. And on that point, Your Honor, what the cases show is that if the parties, by their own conduct and their own interpretation and their own performance, assume and operate under a written contract, then that is incorporated into an implied contract. And that's what this
was
case...
Was Spectra told in 1997 that Jefferson LBG LLC was canceled by the State Corporation Commission?
I think the testimony was that Mr. Hunter testified that he viewed it as essentially as a name change, that it was always the same parties.
Okay, so they weren't told?
I don't believe they were.
All right. Were they ever told that Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services, Inc., a separate entity with separate shareholders, was de facto taking over a contract for which they were not a party? Were they ever told that in 1998?
I don't believe they were, Your Honor.
Were they ever told in 2000 that UniWest, another completely different corporate entity with completely different articles of incorporation, was silently taking over a contract and not telling the other contracting party?
That, Your Honor, they were told of. They were aware of the sale of UniWest buying the assets of UniWest Commercial, or Jefferson Commercial.
But it wasn't a stock sale, it was an asset purchase agreement.
And within that sale, that there was actually specific reference to the contracts that we're here for today. And
I believe Mr. Jefferson Commercial didn't own the contract, wasn't a party to the contract.
And I believe Mr. Hunter testified at trial, though, that he was aware of that, that the fact that there was a transfer there, and that even he assumed and understood that UniWest was buying those contracts. He continued to then operate on that assumption for the next roughly 14 years. With regard to that issue, and that's the first assignment of error, with regard to that issue,
Can you stop just one moment? All of that may be so, but the beliefs of the parties are not the determinative factor. It's the conduct of the parties, isn't it?
That's correct.
So what they believe they might have purchased can't fly in the face of what they legally purchased.
That's correct, and I think the conduct supports the fact that the express contract was incorporated into the implied contract in this case. For example, the testimony was that over the, I believe, roughly 13, 14 years after UniWest purchased these contracts, that everyone then looked back to the contract for billing purposes. Mr. Hunter looked back to the contract when he wanted UniWest to subordinate itself to his lender. He stated in testimony that he actually provided those contracts to his lender to represent to them that, yes, UniWest was the management company under these contracts. There was significant testimony, despite what my colleague stated, that even Mr. Hunter understood that the express contract was what bound everybody, and he performed under that. He continued to pay monthly invoices based on those contracts.
But he was never told that Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services took over the contract 2 years after the contract was made.
Correct, and that's where then I think the conduct of the parties then is key. What did the parties do after that happened?
Well, and it seems to me your point's a great one in terms of conduct, ratifying, pricing, and time of payment, and things like that, the mechanics of making this whole thing run. But only issue, as I understand it, in this case, is a single clause, a termination clause, in a two-year, no automatic renewal contract. That's not ever linked to any conduct of either of the contracting parties.
I believe where the conduct there is, Your Honor, is again, we go back to the subordination agreement, and the testimony of Mr. Hunter was that he was representing, to even his lender, that this entire contract was the contract between these parties. So his conduct was, in his testimony even at trial, he admitted this, was that he understood and he operated as if this entire contract was in place. So the question then comes down to...
But wasn't he misled? He probably assumed that because he thought Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services, Inc. was basically an alter ego of Jefferson LBG LLC.
But even his conduct supports the fact that that the entire contract was incorporated into these implied contracts. For example, when he emails UniWest, which is in the record, asking them to subordinate themselves to this contract, he is saying to them, this entire contract is in place. This is what we're operating under. When he paid the invoices based on that entire contract, there's never an instance where he said, I'm only going to apply or operate under the billing portions, or I'm only going to operate under the term portions. What he was saying to them was, I'm operating under this entire contract. That was his conduct. That's what supports.
Well, if that were true, we'd have an express contract. We'd have an after-the-fact ratification of a contract by different parties. But that was the holding of the trial court. There's no express contract here.
I think what the case law says is, in this case, where the parties, there is no express contract because it has expired. Well, they have an implied contract. So the question is then, what does that implied contract include? And you then look to the conduct of the parties. The
Why does it include a six-month termination liquidation fee? Why does it include that clause? Put aside everything else you've been talking about. What does it say about that clause, the conduct of the parties?
Because, again, Mr. Hunter was incorporating the entire contract in asking them about the subordination agreement, in referencing the entire contract. The testimony, again, was, I believe, on the Joint Appendix 73 through 79. Mr. Hunter testifies that the parties used the contract to calculate the fees for 17-plus years. He refers back to the subordination agreement as the binding contract between the parties on pages 77 through 80.
I think Justice Kelsey is asking the same question that I was asking. Is there any evidence, testimonial evidence, documentary evidence of any sort, that these parties even address the termination clause and the liquidation provisions during this period of time when it was an implied, in fact, contract? there's evidence actually. You could have had a letter back and forth. We have this clause here, and we just want to make it clear that this is what we think is operative. The answer comes back, I think you're right. That's correct. I don't see anything in this record that ever addresses the termination clause that Justice Kelsey is asking about.
Correct. And I think what the justices then are asking for is, were there specific references as to what was incorporated into this implied contract?
Right.
And there was not. There was never a sit-down discussion where the parties said, well, we're going to incorporate clause 4.1 or 11.4.
So what we have is, by law, it's not an incorporation of the express contract. It would be an express contract if you ratified it. So it's not an express contract. So don't we have to go piece by piece to determine what is a part of the implied in fact contract? And you're clearly right that the payment aspect of it was followed very carefully by both parties. But what in this record incorporates or ratifies or by conduct makes a contract implied in fact on the termination clause?
And I believe the key piece of evidence there for Judge Devine was the subordination agreement, where Mr. Hunter specifically said to them, this is incorporated within the subordination agreement was reference to the entire contract. When he was asked by his lender on testimony, what is the contract that's binding your management company? He gave them the entire contract was his testimony. When he was then questioned by Uniwest and asked them to sign it, the discussion was about the entire contract. There was never a discussion about, well, we're only going to operate under the
hadn't he been misled? He obviously assumed that Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services had a contract that they could assign in an asset purchase to Uniwest, but they didn't have a contract they could assign.
With regard to being misled, I would respectfully disagree that he was not misled. It was even his understanding that this contract was what bound him. No one misled him as to what was the actual contract.
Let me break it out then. Did Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services, Inc. have an asset that incorporated these two contracts? And were those assets part of the sale in 2000 to Uniwest?
Yes, they were.
So you're saying Jefferson Commercial Real Estate Services, Inc. had a contractual ownership interest in the relationship that Jefferson LBG LLC, which was canceled in 1997, based upon a 1995 agreement with Spectra 4.
And I think my answer to that is going to differ than what Judge Devine concluded. Judge Devine concluded that there was no contract, but the entire express contract was incorporated in. My answer to your question, Justice Kelsey, is yes, there was, because what happened was there was a smooth transition from Jefferson LBG to Jefferson Commercial. Jefferson Commercial then ratified the contracts of Jefferson LBG, continued to operate under them. They were sent to the alter ego.
Spectra didn't know that it even happened at the time it happened.
Correct. Well, correct. That's correct. Well, but even they testified, though.
Why am I wrong? That just sounds misleading. If I had a contract with you and you assigned it to your buddy and you kept showing up at the front door and I never knew you assigned it to your buddy and there's a clause that says I should know that if you do that, I would feel a little put out if I later found out that your buddy sold it to somebody else.
And what the case law says in that's actually addressed in, I believe, a footnote in the briefing, that contracts are freely assignable in Virginia. That, again, I think we're talking about whether Jefferson LBG assigned the contract to Jefferson Commercial, and I believe legally they did. I think this is different than what Judge Devine ruled, and I think perhaps not something even the court needs to address because we're obviously limited by what Judge Devine.
The Spectra contracts didn't have a non-assignability clause or an assignability with approval clause?
I believe the assignment clause had something to do with it can only be to a successor. And in this case, what the testimony was that the Jefferson LBG was owned by the same person. It was operated as the same business. It was had the same phone numbers, had the same contacts, had the same employees. That legally is a successor, in my opinion. On the remaining arguments about waiver, the next question then, really under the assignments of error, is whether the termination clause was properly or improperly waived by the owner. And I would contend that they did waive, and Judge Devine agreed with that. And I believe that his conclusions and his findings of facts in that regard are subject or entitled to considerable deference. As this Court's aware, findings of facts that come from the trial court are armed with a presumption of correctness. I believe Judge Devine's findings in that regard are correct, and they should be affirmed. On the...
Again, if we disagree with you on the first one, we don't get to the second one, do we?
That's correct. It's sort of a three-hurdle argument. The first one is obviously there needs to be an incorporation of the express contract into the implied. The next issue then is whether the termination for cause clause within the contract was waived. And then the next issue is whether the non-waiver clause within that contract is itself waivable. So there's sort of a three-hurdle process to this step. And, three hurdles that Judge Devine overcame and ruled in my client's favor. On the third issue about the non-waiver, there is, in fact, case law, and I would say conflicting case law in Virginia, that a non-waiver clause is itself waivable. I cite to the Perry case, which is a Fourth Circuit case, and then the Woodman case out of this court, both of which say that by conducts or acts or course of dealing, a non-waiver clause can itself be waived. My colleague cites to really one case, Chesapeake case, and then cites to various federal courts that then interpret that case. I would contend with regard to the federal cases that those cases actually misinterpret the ruling of this court. The Chesapeake case had to do with a construction contract, and I think it's easily distinguishable from the cases that I cite. For example, in the Chesapeake case, that included an express contract. We're obviously dealing with an implied contract in this case, so very different. And it's actually something that even the Chaz case, the federal court, noted would be, if you're dealing with an implied contract and a non-waiver issue, that court even expressed acknowledge that the ruling would probably be different, and that court did not address this exact situation. They sort of expressly decided not to address it.
So your implied contract incorporates by reference the written termination provision, but doesn't incorporate by reference the anti-oral waiver provision.
It does. So the whole contract is in on the implied contract.
So why is the distinction you just raised between implied in fact contracts and express contracts relevant to the waiver concept?
Because for an implied contract, you're dealing with mainly conduct. So the conduct here was that over a course of 10 years, they didn't care about the non-waiver clause or the termination clause. They just never addressed it. And they even stated in testimony that it was just not significant to them
isn't that the point he's making? Apparently the termination clause wasn't significant either.
It wasn't significant to the owner because they never raised it.
It wasn't significant to either one of you. Nobody talked about it. It never came up. It wasn't an issue. It was never tested.
And the only time it would be tested would be when the owner was terminated.
Right.
And when they did terminate it, it came up immediately. With regard to the Chesapeake case, though, not only was it an express contract, but there's no reference in that case whatsoever to conduct. The federal cases that then apply it always refer back to conduct. There's no reference in Chesapeake that extends to conduct. Importantly, the Chesapeake case also had to do with the refusal to impute waiver by agents to an owner. So that's not the case here. We're talking about a waiver by the actual owner. I notice my time is up. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Roche, thank you very much. Mr. Chernoff.
Thank you. I just want to clarify some of the factual matters here. Judge Devine actually stopped her in the middle of trial and leaned down to the witness, Suzanne Farr, and just to clarify, were there any transactions between your entity over here, Jefferson LVG, and this other entity, which is a distinct entity formed at a different time, different state corporation commission number, were there any transactions whatsoever between Jefferson LVG and Jefferson Commercial? And she said no. So those contracts were never assigned, transferred, novated, moved between LBG and Commercial, and then LBG just termed out. It canceled, and the contracts canceled. My clients were not informed that there was another entity managing the building as of 1998. And my clients were not informed that in 1999 there was an asset purchase agreement in which Jefferson Commercial purported to sell these contracts to Uniwest. In fact, we didn't see the asset purchase agreement until 2012. What we got was a letter in January of 2000 that said that Uniwest had partnered with Suzanne Farr. That was the extent of the knowledge given to my clients. I also want to address something Justice Lemon referenced in an earlier argument, which is what needs to be decided and what doesn't need to be decided. If the court reverses on the first assignment of error, it doesn't reach assignment of errors 2 and 3, which is whether waiver occurred. And if it otherwise would have occurred with the waiver only in writing clause, save my clients from having waived. That said, I do think those issues are of great import. Ultimately, though, UniWest is asking the court to take a number of extraordinary, unprecedented steps. What UniWest wishes the court to do is to expand the concept of contracts implied in fact to include belief, in essence, to move it away from acts and conducts that are observable by third parties and move it into a nebulous realm of belief and open up, you know, all sorts of potential problems in trial. Next, the UniWest wishes the court to disregard, for example, the Stanley's cafeteria case, in which this court held that 18 years of inaction, parties sat on its rights for 18 years, but it didn't have to invoke them, and that silence, that inaction, that neglect, that's the word used in the case, didn't constitute waiver. Well, here, my clients didn't invoke the just cause clause, and mind you, they didn't have to because there were no written agreements, but even if written agreements bound them, they didn't invoke it for 10 years, but you'd have to overrule Stanley's cafeteria. Your Honor, I am out of time. I very much appreciate the first time. Thank you.
The court will be in recess.
All rise.